You're listening to a news report podcast from thebodypro.com, the HIV resource for healthcare professionals.
Hi, I'm Ada Atamora from the University of North Carolina School of Medicine's Division of Infectious Diseases. I'm pleased to be talking with you today about African Americans and HIV, new developments in clinical management. I'll be talking briefly about epidemiology, followed by recent studies of mortality and other HIV outcomes, pharmacogenetics, and adverse effects of antiretrovirals, and comorbid conditions that complicate the management of black patients with HIV. Well, first, the epidemiology. The racial ethnic distribution of AIDS diagnoses has changed since the beginning of the epidemic. The proportion of AIDS cases among non-Hispanic blacks and Hispanics has increased. Among people who received an AIDS diagnosis in 2005, about 49% were non-Hispanic blacks, 28% were non-Hispanic whites, 21% were Hispanic, 1% were Asian or Pacific Islanders, and less than 1% were American Indian or Alaska Natives. Blacks, as you can see, account for a disproportionate share of AIDS cases. They comprise about 13% of the U.S. population, yet from 1981 through 2005, they represented about 40% of the total number of AIDS cases reported to the CDC. From 1981 through 2005, 60% of the women and 59% of the children reported as having AIDS were black. In 2005, 48% of AIDS cases reported among adults and adolescents were black. Now, the racial distribution by gender is especially striking. In 2005, of the 10,944 women reported with AIDS, 6,978 were black. Of the 30,956 men, 13,260 were black. Now, those are the reported AIDS cases, that is, those people who came to medical attention. Population-based seroprevalence studies give a clearer picture that includes both those who have already been diagnosed and those who may not yet have come to medical attention. There are few current population-based HIV seroprevalence studies of the general U.S. population, but available evidence suggests that HIV seroprevalence is high among blacks, much higher than among whites. Among more than 13,000 young adults and adolescents in the national population-based study AdHealth, the HIV seroprevalence among blacks was estimated to be almost 0.5%, that is, 20-fold greater than that among whites. The National Health and Nutrition Examination Surveys, or NHANES as it's called, another national population-based study, estimated that HIV rates among whites are low, 0.26% among 18 to 39-year-olds, but much higher among blacks, 1% among young black women, 2.8% among older black women, and even higher among black men, almost 2% among young black men, and 4.5% among older black men. It's important to keep in mind that these figures estimate the U.S. civilian non-institutionalized population and do not include the homeless or the incarcerated, whose rates are substantially higher. Male same-sex activity is the most frequent transmission mode among all men, including black men, but heterosexual transmission is more common among black men than men of other races and ethnicities. Among all women, including black women, sexual contact is the most common means of transmission. Why are HIV rates so high among African Americans? Well, one contributor is likely sexually transmitted infections other than HIV. STIs, sexually transmitted infections, facilitate HIV transmission, and African Americans have high rates of several STIs. For example, the black-white ratios of infection are 8 to 1 for chlamydia, 18 to 1 for gonorrhea, 6 to 1 for syphilis, and about 3 to 1 for herpes simplex virus 2. In addition, bacterial vaginosis, which is not clearly a sexually transmitted infection, is considerably more common among black women. A growing body of evidence suggests that bacterial vaginosis increases risk of acquiring HIV. It's unclear how much other biological factors contribute to the racial disparity in HIV infection rates. People who are homozygous for a 32 base pair deletion in the CCR5 gene are highly resistant to HIV infection. This mutation, actually quite uncommon among whites, less than 1%, is even less common among African Americans. Heterozygosity of the CCR5 gene, a more frequent mutation than the homozygous state, is considerably more common among whites than blacks, and may decrease susceptibility to HIV infection and slow progression of disease. Now, male circumcision decreases men's risk of acquiring HIV infection through vaginal intercourse. The prevalence of circumcision among African American men, 73%, is slightly lower than among white men at 88% in the United States. So to summarize some of the epidemiologic findings, in the United States, blacks are disproportionately affected by AIDS, and drivers of the epidemic among African Americans include the high prevalence of other STDs that facilitate HIV transmission, the high background HIV prevalence that increases individuals' likelihood of acquiring HIV, and sexual network patterns such as concurrent sexual partnerships and mixing among different risk group subpopulations that promote population HIV spread. It's important to remember that poverty, inequality, and discrimination influence behavior and also increase risk of infection associated with behavior, as well as increase infection risk independently of behavior. Finally, biological factors such as distribution of CCR5 gene mutations and prevalence of circumcision may play a role, although the extent of influence these factors have is unclear. Now let's talk briefly about mortality and morbidity outcomes among African Americans with HIV infection. It's well known that HART, highly active antiretroviral therapy, has markedly decreased mortality overall among patients with HIV. How has HART impacted mortality and morbidity among African Americans? Well, investigators at Meharry and Morehouse examined black-white differences in HIV disease mortality before and after the introduction of HART. They used as their data source the National Center for Health Statistics mortality file from 1990 through 2002 and examined HIV-related mortality among blacks and whites in 3,141 counties, parishes, independent cities, and also in Washington, D.C. The outcome of interest for this study was age and gender-specific black-white mortality rate ratios, as this measure reflects racial disparities in death rates. They found that the black-white mortality rate ratio widened significantly after the introduction of HART. That is, racial disparities actually increased after HART, especially among women and elderly. Racial disparities in mortality, as I mentioned, were particularly great among women. Black women in all age groups had about a 13-fold greater risk of dying from HIV compared to white women of the same age range. Older black women were at especially high risk. Black women aged 65 through 74 had a greater than 20-fold risk of death compared to white women. Racial disparities were also significant among men, but in only one age group, that is, men from between the ages of 75 and 84, was black men's relative risk greater than 13 times that of white men's. County-level socioeconomic indicators, for example, indices of inequality such as the black-white poverty rate ratio, and demographic indicators, such as proportion of black residents, were important predictors of post-HART disparities among black men and black mortality in general. Pre-HART era mortality rates predicted post-HART era mortality among black men. It was also noteworthy that the mortality rate ratio varied among communities. Communities had different vulnerabilities to disparity. The authors concluded that unequal diffusion into U.S. communities of HART, which is a critically important innovation, obviously, had occurred, perhaps due to factors such as lack of health insurance, inequalities in care, and differential referral to clinical trials. This may have rendered some communities more vulnerable than others to racial disparities. Early in the HART era, some studies indicated that blacks were less likely to receive HART, unfortunately. Now that we're later in the HART era, more recent studies continue to support these findings. A multi-state, multi-site patient cohort examined this issue. The authors considered patients eligible for HART if they had at least two CD4 counts under 350. They found that 91% of eligible patients received HART. Demographic disparities were noted: African Americans, injection drug users, patients who were uninsured or who had private insurance were less likely to receive HART. Blacks were less likely to receive HART even after controlling for outpatient utilization and number of CD4 tests. Palella and colleagues presented an interesting study at the 2008 CROI. They examined mortality risk among more than 2,000 patients enrolled in the HIV outpatient study in 7 cities in the U.S. from 1999 through 2005, and they followed the patients for a mean of 5.9 years. People with public insurance were more likely to die than those with non-public insurance, and non-Hispanic blacks were more likely to die than Hispanics or non-blacks. Non-Hispanic black race or ethnicity, increased age, and lower CD4 at heart initiation were independently associated with increased mortality risk in multivariable analysis. CD4 initiation at heart was lower for publicly insured compared to non-publicly insured patients, and for non-Hispanic blacks compared to non-blacks. Is differential access to care the problem? And that's a question you might ask. Another study presented at CROI this year examined mortality differentials in a setting with equal access to care. In this longitudinal U.S. military cohort with 1,031 participants who started heart between 1996 and 2006, 73% of whites and 59% of blacks achieved suppression 6 months after starting drugs. A number of factors that one would expect to be associated with increased likelihood of virologic suppression were, in fact, independently associated with that outcome in the study, and they included having a lower baseline viral load, a higher nadir CD4 count, no prior AIDS event, and no prior antiretroviral use. All those people were more likely to achieve virologic suppression. But more difficult to explain was race. Whites were more likely to achieve virologic suppression with an odds ratio of about 2. It's noteworthy that there were no racial ethnic differences in 1, initial regimens or those that were given 6 months after the initial regimen, or 2, the proportions of patients who changed or stopped their heart regimens. These differences persisted over time as well. At 12 months, whites were still more likely to achieve virologic suppression with an odds ratio of 1.7. The authors concluded that despite access to free health care and starting similar heart regimens, African Americans had only half the odds as European Americans of achieving viral suppression 6 months after starting heart. Again, this difference persisted at 12 months and was not explained by discontinuations or changes in initial therapy. Findings from Nashville echo the results of these other studies. In a retrospective study of patients receiving care there, blacks experienced significantly greater mortality than non-blacks. After adjusting for baseline demographic and clinical characteristics, death was associated with being female, black, or an injection drug user. Importantly, blacks and women were less likely to receive antiretroviral therapy, even when their baseline CD4 counts were less than 200. So in summary, in the post-heart era, blacks continue to have disproportionately increased mortality compared to non-blacks. Disparities are substantial for men and women, and are especially great for women and the elderly. These disparities appear to relate to some degree to inequalities measurable at the contextual level, that is, at the neighborhood or county level, as opposed to only at the individual level. Blacks are less likely to receive heart, and are less likely to achieve virologic suppression when they do receive heart, even after adjusting for relevant clinical and demographic factors. What does this mean for our practices? I think that it means that we need to work to ensure that we offer heart to our patients, to our black patients who are eligible for it, and try to support them in accessing it. For example, through facilitating their consultation with effective social service agencies, social workers, and case management agencies, as well as by providing effective patient education. One other problem is that patients in general have been presenting later for care. Carulli and Moore used the Johns Hopkins HIV clinical cohort to assess immune status and time of HIV diagnosis in antiretroviral naive patients who presented for care between 1990 and 2006. The median presenting CD4 count fell from 371 during 1994 to 276 during 2003 to 2006 overall, and also decreased within individual demographic groups. Blacks had consistently lower CD4 cell counts than whites at presentation for care. Now, although the median time from HIV diagnosis to presentation for care also decreased among blacks during 2003 through 2006, the median time to presentation for care was more than 2.5 times as long as it was for whites. These data have some implications for primary care providers. For one thing, routinization of HIV testing, as recommended by the CDC, will likely be beneficial in diagnosing some patients earlier and facilitating their earlier entry to HIV care. what role does adherence have in virologic outcomes among black patients? A couple of studies demonstrate that self-reported adherence reliably predicts virologic response. The factors most consistently associated with non-adherence are symptoms and adverse drug effects, psychological distress, lack of social or family support, complexity of the heart regimen, low patient self-efficacy, and inconvenience of treatment. Characteristics that don't consistently correlate with antiretroviral therapy adherence include sociodemographic characteristics, substance abuse, depressive symptoms, quality of life, CD4 cell count, knowledge and beliefs about treatment, patient satisfaction with healthcare, and patient-provider relationship. Shackman and colleagues examined relationships between race, virologic failure, adherence, and quality of life in ACTG A5095, in which HIV-positive naive patients were randomized to get either AZT3TC and defavirenz or AZT3TC abacavir and defavirenz. They used several different measures of adherence that indicated whether or not the subject reported perfect adherence during different recall periods, for example, the past 4 days, past weekend, past month, etc. They also measured quality of life. Virologic failure was defined as the first of two successive viral loads greater than or equal to 200 at or after week 16. They found that virologic failure was associated with week 12 non-adherence during the past 4 days for blacks, but not for whites. Race adherence interactions were also noted in other models of adherence, including missing at least one medication dose ever, or during the past month, or during the past weekend. It's also worth noting that lower quality of life was an independent predictor of virologic failure, but the effect of quality of life on virologic failure did not vary by race. But the major message is that this study of patients who received an efavirenz-containing regimen, in this study, the penalty for non-adherence, virologic failure, was substantially greater among blacks than whites. This is important given efavirenz's standing in the armamentarium of first-line antiretrovirals. Now, concerning pharmacogenetics, some studies have noted racial differences in the pharmacogenetics of efavirenz. This drug is metabolized mainly by cytochrome P450, the CYP2B6 gene. Numerous polymorphisms of this gene occur, and the distribution of these polymorphisms varies somewhat by race ethnicity. For example, in G516T, a CYP2B6 genetic variant, the TT substitution occurs in 3.4% of whites, 20% of blacks, and 6.7% of Hispanics. This polymorphism is associated with decreased efavirenz clearance with resultant increased plasma efavirenz levels and increased CNS side effects during the first week of treatment. However, in David Haas's analysis of the ACTG studies that examined pharmacogenetics of response to efavirenz, tolerance to CNS effects developed despite persistently increased levels of the drug, and the TT substitution was not associated with virologic failure. Efavirenz has a long half-life and a low genetic barrier to resistance. Simultaneously stopping all drugs in an efavirenz-containing regimen may result in functional efavirenz monotherapy that selects for drug-resistant virus. As I mentioned a moment ago, some CYP2B6 polymorphisms are associated with lower plasma efavirenz clearance. Heather Roboto and her colleagues examined the relationships between the 516 TT polymorphism and plasma efavirenz concentration time profiles after stopping therapy. They found increased efavirenz half-life, doubled in some cases, with some polymorphisms. The longest half-lives occurred with the TT genotype, which is more common, as I mentioned, in African Americans. This increased half-life may predict increased risk of developing drug resistance among patients with this polymorphism who discontinue efavirenz. This finding is relevant to patients who stop an efavirenz-containing antiretroviral regimen and don't immediately start another effective regimen, but it's not relevant to people who promptly switch to another effective antiretroviral regimen upon discontinuing efavirenz. The clinical implication is that when you're stopping an efavirenz-containing regimen, you need to replace efavirenz with a protease inhibitor or some other antiretroviral for a duration sufficient to ensure efavirenz clearance to minimize the chances of developing resistance. So in summary, blacks have a somewhat higher frequency of CYP2B6 gene polymorphisms that are associated with decreased efavirenz clearance and increased CNS adverse effects in the first week. Tolerance to these high levels develops, however. Patients with these polymorphisms probably have a higher risk of developing resistance if they stop an efavirenz-containing regimen without starting another one. Patients who are non-adherent to an efavirenz-containing regimen are more likely to develop virologic failure, and one wonders whether these polymorphisms are the reason why. Nevertheless, efavirenz is an important drug in the HIV armamentarium for blacks and whites. And it should be noted that despite the data that I mentioned, in clinical practice, most black patients tolerate efavirenz well. Let's consider adverse effects of other antiretrovirals. These adverse effects of a few antiretrovirals vary slightly by race. For example, HLA-B5701 positivity is associated with the Bacavir hypersensitivity reaction. Whites have a higher risk, about 5 to 8%, for a Bacavir hypersensitivity reaction than blacks do, but hypersensitivity reaction does also occur in blacks. About 2 to 3% of blacks who are given a Bacavir experience hypersensitivity. HLA-B5701 testing is 100% sensitive as a marker for the Bacavir hypersensitivity reaction in both blacks and whites and should be performed before prescribing a Bacavir. In other words, one shouldn't assume that blacks have no risk of a Bacavir hypersensitivity. Other unusual adverse effects can occur. For example, zidovudine occasionally causes reversible hyperpigmentation of nails or oral mucosa in black patients, which can be upsetting to them. Similarly, on rare occasions, emtricitabine causes hyperpigmentation of palms or soles. This occurs in fewer than 2%, but when it does occur, it does so almost exclusively in black patients. Comorbidities are an important determinant of survival in HIV-positive patients, especially blacks. Among blacks in the United States, cardiovascular disease occurs in 41% of men and 45% of women over the age of 20. Almost half of black women, about 49.7%, and more than a quarter of black men are obese. Among African Americans, the age-adjusted prevalence of hypertension in one national study was 40.5%. Only 29.8% had adequate blood pressure control. The age-adjusted prevalence of diabetes during 1999 and 2000 was 14.9%, and from 1990 to 2001, the incidence of end-stage renal disease among blacks was four times greater than among whites. In the HIV outpatient study in Baltimore I mentioned earlier, you will recall that black patients had higher mortality rates. The authors found that non-AIDS causes of death, many of which are preventable, such as cardiac, renal disease, diabetes, and cancer, caused the majority of deaths among all HIV-positive patients. This finding led the study's authors to conclude that modifiable health risks may contribute to racial disparities in death rates among HIV-positive patients. I'd like to talk for a few minutes about some of the more recent findings concerning chronic kidney disease among black patients with HIV. Chronic kidney disease is defined as a GFR less than 60 or evidence of kidney damage for more than 3 months. Risk factors for chronic kidney disease among HIV-positive patients include factors present in the general population. These include diabetes, hypertension, race, specifically being black, and other genetic factors, family history, HCV, use of cocaine, smoking cigarettes, and atherosclerotic disease. But risk factors among HIV-positive patients also include some factors that are unique to HIV infection, such as lower CD4 cell count and higher HIV viral load. Kidney biopsies of patients with chronic kidney disease reveal a number of causes of chronic kidney disease among HIV-positive patients. HIV-associated nephropathy is a major cause. Co-infection with hepatitis B virus, hepatitis C virus, or syphilis can cause membranous nephropathy. HCV and mixed cryoglobulinemia can also cause membranoproliferative glomerulonephritis. Biopsies also reveal diabetic and hypertensive nephropathies. And immune complex glomerulonephritis results from production of IgA antibodies directed against HIV antigens. I alluded to HIV-associated nephropathy a moment ago. Now, HIV-associated nephropathy, or HIVN, is a collapsing focal segmental glomerulosclerosis that typically results in nephrotic syndrome. Among HIV-positive patients with chronic kidney disease who have undergone renal biopsy, it has accounted for more than 60% of chronic kidney disease diagnoses. It results from direct HIV infection and gene expression, especially NEFs and VPR in tubular and glomerular epithelial cells. HIVAN occurs almost exclusively among blacks. Prevalence among blacks is 12-fold greater than among whites. It has a stronger association with black race than any other cause of renal failure except sickle cell anemia. It's not that rare either. In one study, the prevalence of HIVAN among HIV-positive black patients was 3.5%. The disease has an aggressive course with rapid progression to end-stage renal disease. Ultrasound usually reveals normal to large echogenic kidneys, but specific diagnosis requires biopsy. Among patients with HIVAN, antiretroviral therapy is associated with preserved renal function and prolonged survival. So a very important clinical issue is that according to the current HIV treatment guidelines, HIVAN is an indication for antiretroviral therapy regardless of CD4 count. A recent study suggests that the pace of kidney disease differs between black and white HIV-positive patients. Lucas and colleagues did an interesting study and found in a Baltimore cohort of HIV-positive patients that blacks were at increased risk for incident chronic kidney disease with a significant hazard ratio of 1.9. After adjustment for other factors, specifically sex, age, AIDS status, injection drug use, and calendar time, the association between race and chronic kidney disease fell a little to 1.65. Once chronic kidney disease developed, blacks developed end-stage renal disease much faster than whites. The hazard ratio for development of end-stage renal disease among blacks was 17.7 compared to whites, and the GFR fell 6 times faster among blacks than whites. These data suggest that although the risk of chronic kidney disease is slightly higher in HIV-positive blacks than in whites, much of the markedly increased risk of end-stage renal disease among blacks is due to faster progression of chronic kidney disease once it starts. Indeed, blacks with chronic kidney disease had more aggressive disease features. One thing, they were more likely to have high-grade proteinuria, and as I mentioned earlier, a faster GFR decline. The Lucas study has some implications for our clinical practice. First, as the IDSA recommends, we should incorporate renal screening into routine HIV care. In addition, the cohort study implies that ACE inhibitors and ARB drugs decrease the risk of progression to end-stage renal disease in HIV-positive patients with chronic kidney disease. Early identification of chronic kidney disease may maximize benefits of therapy. In addition, the serum creatinine-based GFR is a relatively insensitive marker of early kidney disease. It's recommended that we actually do urinalysis annually or quantify the urine protein creatinine ratio. And finally, it raises a question of whether or not we should perhaps consider starting heart earlier during the course of HIV disease. A few years ago, the Infectious Diseases Society of America published practice guidelines for renal screening and evaluation of HIV-positive patients. All HIV-positive patients should be screened with urinalysis for detection of proteinuria and serum creatinine to estimate creatinine clearance or GFR. All should undergo a qualitative assessment for risk of kidney disease with evaluation factors such as race, family history, CD4 count, HIV viral load, history of use of nephrotoxic medications, and comorbidities such as diabetes, hypertension, and HCV infection. Black patients and patients with risk factors are considered high risk. If upon screening there's no proteinuria, those people at high risk should be screened annually. People who have neither proteinuria nor risk factors should be followed clinically. If screening studies are abnormal, that is, greater than or equal to 1 plus proteinuria, or a GFR less than 60, the patient should receive a spot urine protein to creatinine ratio and a renal ultrasound, and consideration of referral to a nephrologist for further evaluation and possibly for renal biopsy. So in summary, HIV-positive black patients are at increased risk for renal disease. Among HIV-positive patients, renal disease appears to progress more rapidly among blacks than whites. More than half of chronic kidney disease diagnoses are due to HIV-associated nephropathy on biopsy. HIV-associated nephropathy occurs almost exclusively among blacks and is due to direct HIV infection. It's diagnosed definitively only by renal biopsy and is an indication for heart, regardless of CD4, so it's important to diagnosis. IDSA guidelines recommend annual screening and, if appropriate, further workup for all black patients and others with risk factors for renal disease. I'll mention hepatitis B virus infection very briefly, as co-infection has implications for HIV management. The Adult-Adolescent Spectrum of HIV Disease Project looked at 16,248 HIV-positive patients who were receiving care in 11 geographic areas in the United States and found that the incidence of acute HBV infection was higher among black patients, but that the prevalence of chronic HBV infection was actually pretty similar among whites and blacks. Liver-related mortality is higher among those with co-infection than those with either HIV alone or chronic HBV infection alone. It's recommended that all HIV-positive patients be screened for HBV infection. HBV vaccine should be given to people who are not immune to hepatitis B virus, and presence of persistent HBV infection informs the selection of HIV antiretroviral therapy. All co-infected patients should abstain from alcohol, and they should receive hepatitis A vaccine if they're not immune. If treatment for HIV or HBV is needed, it's recommended that you give antiretroviral therapy that suppresses both viruses, for example, tenofovir plus either emtricitabine or lamivudine. We should avoid using tenofovir, emtricitabine, or lamivudine alone because of the risk of HBV resistance. Now, concerning hepatitis C, the prevalence of HCV antibody in the U.S. general population is greater among blacks than whites at 3.5% versus 1.8% respectively. About 20% of patients with HCV clear the virus spontaneously after acute infection. Blacks, symptomatic patients, and HIV-infected patients are least likely to spontaneously clear. After acute HCV infection, 80% of patients develop chronic HCV infection. 20 to 50% of those with chronic infection develop cirrhosis. It's important to note that HIV infection accelerates the development of cirrhosis. There is a approximately 0 to 3% per year risk of developing hepatocellular cancer once cirrhosis develops. The risk of developing hepatocellular cancer is greater with infection due to HCV genotype 1B than 2A or 2C. Concerning HIV-HCV co-infection, all HIV-positive patients should be screened for HCV infection, including those with normal LFTs. Significant liver fibrosis has been reported in up to 25 to 40% of co-infected patients with a normal ALT, a prevalence higher than the 10 to 30% of fibrosis reported in HCV mono-infected individuals. In two recent studies, 12 to 14% of co-infected patients with normal ALT had cirrhosis on liver biopsy. All patients with HCV infection should abstain from alcohol, receive HIV and HBV vaccines if they're not immune, and they should also be evaluated for HCV therapy. The indications for HCV therapy among people who are HIV negative are detectable plasma HCV RNA and bridging or portal fibrosis on liver biopsy. Again, it's important to note that ALT levels don't accurately reflect the severity of HIV-associated liver disease. There are contraindications, though, to pegylated interferon and ribavirin. For example, pregnancy, refusal to use contraception, decompensated liver disease, renal insufficiency, untreated major depression, and advanced cardiopulmonary disease. Pegylated interferon plus ribavirin results in the highest rates of HCV clearance in HIV-positive patients, and they typically have about a 27 to 40% sustained viral response. Predictors of sustained viral response among co-infected patients are having HCV genotype 2 or 3 and a low baseline HCV viral load. Host factors are also predictors, and these include younger age, lower body mass index, lack of insulin resistance, and non-black ethnicity. Black patients are less likely to have a sustained viral response. HCV status and treatment schedule, for example, getting optimal doses of pegylated interferon and or ribavirin, having a long enough duration of therapy, and good adherence are also all predictors. In summary, it's important to screen all patients for co-infection with HBV and HCV. Patients who are not immune to HIV and HBV should be vaccinated. Co-infected patients should be advised to abstain from alcohol. knowledge of HBV co-infection informs selection of HIV treatment to decrease the possibility of selecting for HBV resistance. Patients with HCV infection should be evaluated for treatment of this virus. The advent of HART has decreased death rates from HIV, but substantial racial disparities in virologic outcomes and mortality persist, even among those who receive HART. The pharmacology of drugs is generally similar among blacks and whites, with a few exceptions. Blacks are more likely to have genetic polymorphisms that result in decreased efavirenz clearance and appear more likely to have virologic failure when they don't adhere to efavirenz than non-adherent whites. Blacks with HIV are more likely than whites to have comorbid conditions, such as diabetes, obesity, and chronic kidney disease that complicate their HIV management. Among patients with chronic kidney disease, blacks are more likely than whites to progress to end-stage renal disease. Moreover, HIV-associated nephropathy, which can have a particularly aggressive course, occurs almost exclusively among blacks. HIV-associated nephropathy is an indicator for initiation of HART, regardless of CD4 count. Liver disease is an important cause of mortality among patients with HIV, and HCV infection, a major cause of HIV-related liver mortality, is more common among African Americans.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a News Report podcast from thebody.com. Be sure to check in at thebody.com frequently for the latest news and information on HIV, including in-depth interviews with HIV-positive people, researchers, and healthcare professionals.